This is Dish and Dirt with Gary Pickren, South Carolina's only podcast dedicated to the real estate agent craft. And now, the host of Dish and Dirt, Gary Pickren.
And greetings, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Dish and Dirt. I'm your often opinionated but rarely wrong host, Gary Pickren, coming to you from the beautiful offices of Blair Cato Pickren Castellan in downtown Columbia, South Carolina. This, the fourth week of October. So, this week we're going to talk about loan assumptions. It's something that we have started to see for the first time in my 28 years of practicing law. Had our first loan assumption I can ever recall in the office VA loan. And so, what we're going to do today is talk about loan assumptions. Are they viable? Is it something that we could actually look at for our buyers when we have interest rates in the sevens? Can we look at assuming a loan in the twos or the threes? Is it possible? How does it work at the VA? Is it something that a seller could advertise? What does the loan process look like to do the assumption? And what issues and problems should we be concerned with? So we're going to examine that today on Dish and Dirt. I got my friend Brad Allen will be with us. He is co-owner of The Art of Real Estate, and he is going to go through his experience in dealing with a VA assumption just a few weeks ago and some of the things that he has found out working through those processes. So let's go ahead and jump in with Brad Allen today. All right, guys, joining me is Brad Allen. As I told y'all earlier, I have been doing this podcast now right over 3 years, and Brad was actually my second guest on Dish and Dirt. So if you go back to episode number 2, you'll find Brad Allen in that episode. Episode number 1 was Candace McEwen. Episode number 2 was Brad Allen. And since that date, Brad has literally been begging, pleading to get back on Dish and Dirt. He's been bribing me, sending me prizes and presents and anything he could do to get back on Dish and Dirt. And, you know, basically right. After 3 years of it, I've just finally relented and I said, what the heck? I'll have Brad Allen, the owner of Art of Real Estate, the founder of the Art of Real Estate. I'll have him back on. So, Brad, you beat me down. You're back on. What do you want to talk about?
The same way I got married.
Same way, exactly.
I got married, Gary. Beat you down. Co-owner, right? Don't let Mary Lane hear this. Co-owner and founder. Okay, Mary Lane, Sloan, my partner. She'll kill me. Yeah, dude. So let's, you know, I'm an active broker. Let's talk about some assumptions because I know everybody's heard about them or they think they've heard about them, but man, is a slippery, slippery thing to get a hold of. So I think we should talk about that today.
All right. So let's talk about them. I've been doing real estate now for 28, almost 29 years, and I have done I've done no assumptions. But in our office last month, we did our first assumption for a VA loan. And it was actually a very smart deal instead of doing, and that was yours, yep. I think, actually. Yep. It was a very smart deal. We wound up taking, from what I understand, and I'll let you explain. Actually, why don't we just do that? Why don't you explain that transaction and why that was a good deal for your buyer?
Yeah, let's talk about how not to do it, first of all. And what's not to do it is make up your own wording, put it in the contract, and then let your broker see it a week later and try and figure out how to actually go through it. So first of all, I'm not everybody's broker, but if you got one, you better talk to somebody before you start writing some assumptions because it is not a straightforward thing. But yeah, so to break it down for people that aren't kind of that knowledgeable on assumptions, right? VA and FHA loans are assumable, meaning buyers can take over the current owner's loan, which is usually a really good interest rate. And they can just take over those loans and those payments, whatever's left. But the difference is what the market rate is and what the loan difference is. So let's just use like $100,000 sales price. And let's say the seller has paid it down to $50,000. So if the $50,000 loan is at 2.2%, you can assume that loan and still pay that $50,000 at 2.2%. But you got to figure out how to get the seller their equity at that other $50,000, and that's where it gets really slippery. So it's great, especially in this market, because you can overtake these loans, but they're not as simple as people think. Think about it this way. The bank that has that 2% interest loan at that $50,000, they don't really, I'm speaking for them, they don't really want you taking that loan over.
Right.
Because they can hopefully get another one at 8% when the person sells it, right? It's just kind of going back into the inventory. So the problem I have run into is there are no timelines. There's no requirements for that bank to respond to my buyer to assume it. I've heard of friends throughout the country that have taken 90 days to get the bank's approval to let the new buyer assume it. And that's the big catch. The buyer has to still be approved for those loan terms. Like they still have to meet all the requirements the initial buyer did. So that can take a little bit. And there's not like, hey, you're going to close in 30 days. I think ours closed in 60 days, and our buyer paid cash for the seller's equity, which is not normal. So a lot of these assumptions I found don't actually work out, because a lot of buyers don't have $50,000 in cash in this scenario to give the seller his equity or her equity so they can go away.
We're talking about the gap between the purchase price and the assumption. So the way Brad calls it the equity, I usually call it the gap. So yeah, that's, if there's a big gap between what you're buying the house for and what you're assuming, you've got to find out a way to cover it. And that ain't easy.
Oh, and it's not 50,000. Think about this, 2020, right? When the market started kicking, we've had 11 to 14% house appreciation for 3 years. So houses are worth 30% more. They bought a $300,000 house. There's $100,000 in equity today, at roundabout math. Most people don't have $100,000. So yeah. I've been doing a little bit of digging. We have a mortgage company, so I've been digging kind of into this pretty deeply. You can get a second loan, right? Back in the day, back in 2006, my first loan was 80-20, right? 80% of the first loan, 20% the second. You can still get that done. I mean, obviously, you got to be approved for it. Equity lines, you could actually roll in with an equity line right out the gate. The difference is, let's use 100,000 again. That 50,000 gap might be at 8% today, or 7%, or whatever you qualify for. But the first one's at 2%. So you kind of average them out. You're doing okay. You're averaging around a 4% loan, which is still beating the market right now.
No doubt.
But that's the hard part, is finding. So you got to have that lender. Your lender needs to be your best friend next to your attorney in these assumptions, because you got to find that gap money through a different loan source, unless your buyer's got cash, which they don't.
So what I'm seeing with these gaps, particularly in the VAs, is that somebody who's been in that house for a long time probably has created a lot of equity, and that gap's going to be very big. Your best chance, seems to me, is that somebody who bought the house probably post-COVID, when the rates were still low, and only has about 2 years worth of equitable growth in their property, which still could be several thousand.
Right.
And then it seems to me the second thing is, you're probably not going to see many enlisted active service members in a financial situation to be able to pay the gap. So you're probably going to be looking more for an officer or a retired veteran to have that. But that kind of brings the second point of this, is it doesn't always have to be a veteran who assumes a veteran loan.
Right.
Talk about that and what the risks are there for the veteran who has the loan.
Yeah, a civilian can take over a VA loan. They still have to get approved through the VA, which we know is no quick thing as well. So for timing, you got to be careful of that.
I understand that it eats up their VA eligibility. So if they want to go out and get another loan, some of their VA eligibility may be eaten up. So that could be a problem.
So it keeps it on their record, if you will.
Yeah. So if it's a civilian,
gotcha.
My understanding is, and if a lender out there has a different understanding, please let us know. But what I've always been taught is, if a non-veteran assumes the VA loan, then the VA still uses that eligibility for that veteran. If a veteran assumes the veteran loan, then that new veteran uses their VA eligibility. So it could cause that veteran. So there are some issues in that. It concerns me. The gap concerns me, but in the event that we did for you, or the assumption we did for your closing, that person was able to bring the cash. And I mean, they went from, I think, what, a 7.5% quote down to about a 2.5% loan, and they saved thousands of dollars a month. I think it was $1,000 a month they saved on the loan. So it's worth looking at these. Are you seeing clients actually ask you about it on the seller side or the buyer side?
Yeah, we had a listing appointment. I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And so I went with one of our newer agents, and the guys in the Navy, in Columbia of all places. But anyways, yeah, they wanted to get the house on the market sooner. Let's say they wanted to move in January. They wanted to put it on the market in September to give time for the assumption, if somebody was going to do it, because they think it's a good idea, which on paper, it's a great idea. In execution, it's almost impossible because of the cash, the gap. So we talked through it, and I said, listen, the average person's probably not going to be able to make up this $100,000 difference. So we didn't say no to it. We definitely marketed it with that in mind. But at the end of the day, I just told them not to hold out hope. Don't change your entire plan for this assumption model to go through. And that's where, again, we're lacking a lot in our state, or a realtor association. Nobody's really put out guidance on how to do this. So that's why it's kind of flying blind a little bit.
It seems to me one of the things that agents could do in marketing for that seller is maybe go ahead and try to partner with maybe a credit union or somebody to say, look, if we bring a buyer to you and we have a $200,000 sell price and there's going to be a $125,000 or $150,000 loan assumption with the other lender, can we market or advertise with you that you can do a second? And if so, what would that rate be so that we can actually show the numbers to somebody? Because I think you're right. If I can assume a 3% mortgage of 150 and then go get a second at 50 and even at 8%, that's a whole lot better than doing a 200 at 7%. So maybe that's something that our agents should start looking at. So you mentioned earlier the big problem with these, other than the gap issue, is the write-up and the time frame of how long it takes to do this. So talk about the issue you saw with the write-up of how to get this into a contract, and then talk also about the time frame. And how do you handle the time frame? Because not every buyer can just say, I'll wait till whenever you get it done, or every seller is going to just hold off on 60, 90, 120 days, I don't care. How do we deal with that?
Yeah. So I think as a buyer's agent, I would take it almost like a short sale used to be. Hey, we're gonna put in for this assumption, and it's not guaranteed you're gonna get it, but you better hold me. We're gonna be a hurry up and wait is what it's gonna be. So I would take the mindset, if any of these guys listening or gals listening have ever done short sales, you got to pack patience and you're willing to ride it out to get the benefit on the flip side. So that's the way I would look at it. I would probably try and make if I was advising my agents, I would do a 90-day close. And then you get into the whole, I mean, I'm not going to try and unbox Pandora right now, but at the same time, you can do rent backs, but you can't do that with VA loans. Like, so there's some things that you could do structurally to make everybody happy. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of liability in advising somebody through an assumption, because there's so many different ways you can take it to make people happy. It's like at the end. So the one we wrote up, and this is what gave me heartburn. My agent wrote up without me knowing it. Hey, we're going to try and assume the loan, blah, 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 by this date. And if we don't, we're going to buy it with this lender. Like, we'll flip the loan. But the contract didn't cover that. And then we're practicing law to an extent, which we got that clarified. But like, it's just, there's so many moving parts that I hope that people can kind of put their heads together with their corporate attorneys and, you know, whoever else and get a game plan. Mine would be a 90-day close. I would probably have a jump off point. So if I flip my hat, I'm a seller. Fine. I'm going to give you 30 days to get approved by my bank. If not, you got to go, you know, conventional financing and go ahead and buy it anyways. It's almost like a perk.
That's actually a very interesting idea, is to do it that way, is to have that kind of drop dead date. I'll give you 30, 60 days to get the assumption approval in. If you don't do it, then you need to convert to a conventional loan, and then you have 30 days. And if you don't do it, then it's out. But it ties up a seller's property for 90 days. Which only works well in a buyer market. I guess in a seller market, if a seller's getting multiple offers, he's not going to want to do that. So I have seen, and that kind of brings another topic. Are you starting to see this market now shift back more toward a buyer market, or is it still 100% seller market?
Man, we're right on that cusp, I believe. Everybody's got a little bit of a difference of opinion what's a seller and buyer's market, right? My belief is 3 months and below is a seller market, 3 to 6 of inventory, excuse me, is a neutral, 6+ is a buyer's. So I think we're about 3 months of inventory in the Midlands, and you're about 2.5 months in the upstate, I saw. So I think you're still in a seller's market, to be honest with you.
But those numbers are a lot better. I remember last summer, you and I were talking of some markets that were like 1 and 2 day markets. I mean, it was insane. Yeah. There were markets with zero houses for listing. So could a seller perhaps go ahead and contact their lender and say, we're looking to do an assumption to sell this as an assumption, tell us the time frames, tell us what we need to do so that we can kind of get ahead of it? Is that something that y'all are advising your clients that are interested in offering this to do?
We are, and we have found that their banks, first of all, want nothing to do with us. They will not talk to us. They will not, because it's not a contract, right? It's a listing agreement, so we want to get in front of it. And they're like, literally, we're not making any money in this deal. Like, we are not putting effort to try and help you in this thing. So I don't know what the banks, they're required to do this for being an FHA and VA lender, but they don't have to be nice about it, and they don't have to put you the top of the stack. So I don't know if it's like a, you know, again, using a short sale where you can kind of get pre-qualified as a short sale, talk to your advisor at the bank and all that. I don't see that happening yet, but maybe banks will get more savvy as these pick up and they start eating up their resources.
I would have assumed, if I was assuming or having somebody assume my VA loan, that somehow the VA might be involved in it, so that I'm going, like you, when you get your VA certificate or whatever, that I don't know, maybe I just wasn't really thinking about it, that I'm really at the mercy of whatever lender. I figured the VA had guidelines and had abilities to be involved, more involved in it. But it seems like you're just dealing with the lender. And like you said, in order to be a VA lender, you just have to allow the assumption. But if they don't have a lot of guidelines on how that assumption works or time frame, that's something I certainly did not know.
Yeah, at least that's been my experience. I might be wrong, and there might be some haters out there that are going to blow us up on this. But my experience is, and talking to friends, I've got some friends in Colorado Springs that do a lot of like this. So I reached out when we started doing these assumptions to figure out what to do. And they said, yeah, I mean, some will answer in 30, some are 90, but there's been no rhyme or reason for them. And they have Colorado has a state form.
Wow, that's something that maybe we need to look at on the contract committee. If there is somebody out there, lender or realtor listening to this that has additional information, please email me at Gary at Blair Cato, because this is something, as you can tell with me and Brad talking here, we're trying to work our way through it. As I said, I've been doing this for 28, 29 years, and I've never done one until Brad brought one to us. And Brad, you've probably only seen a couple of them. So this is something we all need to try to understand. So if y'all have additional information, please give it to me, and I'll use it on next week's podcast as well. I wonder if there's any movement at the National Association of maybe coming up with a mortgage assumption specialist designation where they can actually teach a class. That seems to me that we had the short sale certification back in the day.
Yeah.
And then maybe this is something. I know, aren't you on the NAR leadership still?
Yeah. I still serve in some committees on there. I actually just had a conference this week. I should have asked them. I think their hands are a little full at the moment, but I can reach out to the education people and see if there is something. But when I was Googling around and searching realtor.org or NAR.realtor, I didn't see anything.
So if you're representing a seller, would you be advising them to try to do this? Would you try to be convincing them not to? What are you trying to do with your seller who says, hey, I got a 2.5% mortgage. Let's offer it.
Yeah. So a couple of things I would check with my seller first. What are your timelines? Because the people we were talking to, they had to be gone January 1st. So trying to set that up was going to be real tough. But I would use like a tool in my toolbox, right? So yes, that is a tool in our toolbox to sell your house. I would assume with a listing that is being assumed, I'm going to keep my list price pretty high. I'm probably not going to negotiate because then you're getting a perk of buying my house at a lower interest rate. So I think that's a perk to a seller. But again, it's their timelines, and I would check that. And I would really, as a broker or an agent, think through some things to protect your seller. Again, a kick-out clause, like how long do they have to try and get this done? What if they – here's the question. If they're buying your house and assuming you're alone, and they get denied from the assumption, do they still have to buy the house or they get denied for financing? Like, that's a really gray area.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that either. I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting.
But I would assume if you can get approved as a FHA buyer and it's an FHA loan, that shouldn't be a problem. It's just they may not let you assume it, which I don't understand why. So that's the other clause too. Like, hey, just because you got denied for my assumption doesn't mean you can't still buy my house.
So yeah, and I think
it's going to take a lot of patience.
Yeah, it goes back to what you said earlier, is that this does get to the practice of law. And I know if you're the state association says if you start using punctuation and writing stuff up that you're probably crossing that line. And so, yeah, you do need to be talking to your closing attorney or your company's attorney to try to write these assumptions up. What do you think about sellers advertising and marketing that they have a 2.5% or a 3% assumable loan? Do you think that's a viable thing to do or a valuable thing to do, rather?
I do. I think you've got to watch anytime that you put an interest rate out. So, again, I got a mortgage company. I've learned this. Anytime you put a mortgage, it's called a trigger, a mortgage rate, a payment rate, or anything like that. You have to disclose it. And that goes for realtors too. So like a real estate agent. So you can't just be thrown around. You can assume this at 2.3%. There needs to be a heck of a disclaimer on that, in my opinion. Now
I agree.
You do what your broker tells you to do. So I would be careful of that and I would do it properly. But yeah, if that gets more people through my door and they're willing to pay my price, because remember last year, let's say April of 22, what is it? What year is it? Yeah, April 22. Interest rates were in the fours, so a $300,000 house was really, really cool. But at sevens, $300,000 house ain't cool anymore. So I think I could still get my – because here's another part too. Average price point and median price point are still going up. They've been going up, not a lot, but they're still ticking up. So prices aren't falling, but buyers are buying cheaper, more less expensive houses. So if you can buy this $300 at a 4% rate, now competing with $200,000 houses with a whole different buyer pool. So I think it's another, I would market the heck out of it just in hopes of getting somebody through the door, falling in love with it. Hopefully they can assume it, but if not, they're emotionally invested by it anyways.
Good point. So it seems to me what we're really talking here for a seller is kind of be proactive, do your homework, make sure that if you're going to advertise the assumption that you're doing it the proper way, go ahead and perhaps talk to a credit union or some other bank to see if they can have the second. Because if you do have that big gap, you want to be able to give the buyer an option or an ability to close that gap other than cash. And then maybe proactively reach out to your lender and see if your lender will even discuss with you what the process is and the time frame is. But it sounds like a lot of these lenders obviously are going to try to balk and stall because they don't want that 3% loan on their books anymore. So that seems difficult. On the buyer side, if I'm a buyer and I'm interested in assuming somebody's mortgage, obviously I have the same issues. I got to come up with the gap. I've got to be able to convince the seller of giving me the time to do it. What things are you doing or what things are you advising your agents to do when they approach a seller, even a seller who's not advertising that they have a loan? Are your sellers, buyers asking, hey, can I assume and can we talk to the seller about assuming their loans?
I haven't heard a lot of buyers asking about this. I think it's still kind of not a secret. I think just real estate agents, politely, this isn't a negative, are just ignorant to assumptions. So they're not bringing it up because they really don't understand it. They don't know about it. A little tidbit, though, to get some people off the fence. You imagine if you have a buyer, they're looking at the 300,000 range, and they're doing the whole like, hey, I'm going to wait for interest rates to come down because it's really expensive. Imagine if you said, well, what if I could find you a house with a 4% or less interest rate that you liked? Go in the MLS, at least in the Columbia market. I'm in 11 different MLSs, so I don't know how they all work. But you can search if the seller's agent closed out the file properly in the MLS. It'll say what type of loan they got, conventional FHA, VA. It'll say if they got closing costs, or you can search tax records too. So my point is go in there and search for houses that closed in the last 3 months or still run a search like you normally would, 3-bed, 4-bath, whatever, and then loan type FHA, VA, pull up the list and see if you can find some houses to go knock on the doors, you know, and say, hey, would you sell for the right price? And then your buyer's getting a good interest rate. So I think it's be more of the bootstrapping is what the thing's going to be. Or they find a house they like, go back in the MLS system, see when they sold it last, try and see what type of loan type they got. And then, you know, but you're going to probably have to educate the listing agent on it if they're not advertising it.
As a broker or a brokerage, if you can go ahead and start asking your sellers, do you have an assumable loan, and start kind of compiling a list of, we have 15 listings right now, 10 of them are assumable, 5 of them aren't. And then being able to communicate between the buyer and the seller that we might be able to put you together with an assumption, you're going to need more time, which means you're going to have to probably pay more money to the seller. So when you have a seller that is willing to wait the 60 or 90 days and but want to make more money, then maybe this is something that we can marry together because we've done our homework up front and found the list of our listings that would be willing to do it that actually have assumable loans. And I think the way to convince the sellers, like you said, we'll pay you more money, which is well worth it. Is it not worth paying somebody another $5,000 or $10,000 for their house if I can save that per year for 30 years?
Yep. Yeah, what is that? Right? So that's 4% on 300, that's 12,000, that's $1,000 a month. Yeah.
So that seems to be something we ought to all be trying to figure out. I would hope that the realtors associations, maybe on the national level, would start trying to come up with some more educational stuff. I know you've come up with a lot of great things. Do you think we're going to continue to see more assumptions, or do you think it's just people just don't know enough about it and it's still too tricky to expect much of it from here?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a twofer, right? It's going to be, if interest rates stay up, people, the winners are going to win, right, in real estate, being agents. So you just got to get scrappy and figure it out. So I think you will see more assumptions because that's a golden carrot. Like I said earlier, I can find you a house in your price point for half the interest rate. You've got my attention and I'm willing to do it because you can't argue math. I mean, you can try, but you can't. So if I can get you a good rate, I'm going to get you a good deal, if you will. Now, you still got to get the seller to sell to go buy something with an 8% interest rate. So you still have that issue. But yeah, I think you'll see that. And then again, I think you'll see people that just wash their hands of and go, I'm just going to work with first time home buyers that, you know, don't care about the interest rate. And then we just move on.
Well, I know you used to be 30 under 30 for the National Association of Realtors. You reminded me that when I had Brandon Greenblatt on here. That I already had a 30, and I know you're no longer anywhere close to being under 30 anymore.
Man, come on.
But you're old enough to remember back in the market of the 2007-2008 market where the agents that pivoted and decided, hey, I'm going to become a short sale specialist. I remember there were two or three literally specialists at that. And they were booming in an era when a lot of people were struggling as real estate agents. And this goes exactly to what you said. If you are an agent that's just, you know, really proactive, progressive kind of thinking to do this, maybe this is something to look at. How can I become in the market the smartest, most educated person on assumptions? And how can I use that to increase my market for my buyers, but also for my sellers? And I think there's a very viable option here. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. That's one of those things you're sitting around on a dining table, right? Having a dinner party. And that's what people are going to brag on you about. They're going to go, yeah, I bought a house in November. And my agent got me a 4% interest rate because they did a little bit of digging and had this process. And the other one's going to go, yeah, we're still renting because it's too high. And you're like, oh, well, you're wasting money. I've got a great interest rate. I mean, you'll look, your referrals should be through the roof if you can do this properly. You got to have your attorney. You got to have your process down to a science on this thing.
Yeah. And the person who does that is going to be booming in this. You're 100% right. Hopefully somebody listening to this podcast will take it from there. One last question on a completely different topic as we finish up today. I just wanted to get your 2 minutes on what you think about these lawsuits, these NARS lawsuits, Sitzer and Morrell and Burnett. What do you think the end result's going to be? Do we think we're going to have the death of buyer relationships, buyer agency?
Yeah, so good question. I just got done with some state NAR meetings and some of the leadership team was there. I've been watching Inman updates as they go through because Inman's doing a decent job of just updates, whether they're biased or not, who cares, but they're at least updating. So the plaintiffs are doing a fantastic job. Like they are, here's a good quote I saw. This lady, one of the named plaintiffs on the case, she's probably in her 50s. She sold 5 or 6 houses. Her mom was a realtor for 30 years. Her mom was. And she said, when I sold my last house, the buyer's agent fee was 20% of my equity. Not what the fee was, but they took it as it was my equity that they stole. They all say, we love buyer's agents. We don't have a problem with them. Our agent did a great job, but why am I paying somebody else to negotiate against me? So they're setting it up for these 9 jurors, or now it's 8 jurors because one got dismissed yesterday. They're setting it up so that it's playing on the heartstrings. And of course, these jurors have not bought a house since 2016 because they wouldn't be allowed to be on the panel because those people would be part of the class action. So these are maybe ignorant or older people that have not bought houses in a while and don't know how it works. So I think they're doing a great job on their side, which is blasphemous for me to say. I do not think we're going to have a problem here in South Carolina. We have buyer. You know, I was on a panel and joked and said, you know, usually South Carolina is last, right? We're last in everything, but now we're first because we have to have a buyer agency to show. We know what compensation is. There's no pulling the wool over anybody's eyes like they do in some states. You know, Florida is a transactional state. All of a sudden you get a charge on your settlement statement. You're like, I didn't sign that. I didn't agree to pay that. So that's good. Transactional brokerage only, not for our state, but states like that, it's going to be the death of that. But buyer agency, I don't think it's a problem. And what I would recommend to any agent and broker out there is start working on not just your value prop, but how you're going to still explain to the buyer how you're going to get paid if the seller's not going to pay you. New York, actually, they said yesterday, they just removed the law. So sellers are not allowed to pay buyer's agents.
Wow.
Like it's a whole thing. It just came out. Like it's like the Metro MLA. You have to look it up. But so they're getting in front of this. I don't see a big deal with it. I think winners win. I think people that have value get paid for their value. I think buyer agents have value. But it's going to be a PR dance that agents and realtors have to do now to show their value, not just, hey, I open up doors and here's what I do. Like you got to be good.
So if the end result is that all 50 states go to buyer agency, okay, then that's fair. That's fair. But, you know, it's just I don't think that anybody's really thought through this. They keep thinking like the lenders are going to just pay the buyer real estate agent commission fees. It's not going to happen. That's not practical. There's no way that's going to happen. So my fear is that low income and minorities are going to make it even harder for them to buy houses. And that's something we don't need to see. And it's already hard enough.
No, not at all. And I also think, I know we got to wrap this up, but I also think that it's going to be an issue because lenders are going to have to figure this out, almost like a VA funding fee. You know, they put that on top of the loan. Lenders are going to figure that out or their business is going to dry up as well. So like they're going to have to do something. But at the end of the day, the argument's always been, who pays the commission? it depends what side you're on. If the buyer's paying the price of the house, that has the commission baked in. So I would argue the buyer's paying it. But the seller's saying, I wouldn't have to sell it for as much if I didn't have your commission baked into it. And so the thing I heard, the best thing I heard come out of the defendant's attorney said, the buyer agency's like this. If I lose my dog in my neighborhood and the kid across the street says, hey, Mr. Allen, I will go find your dog. And I agree to pay him $500 to go find my dog. And then he puts posters up all around my neighborhood saying, missing dog. If you find the dog, there's a reward. The person that finds the dog got paid $250, but only if they found the dog. So what I tell my agents is we tell our sellers, like, you're paying me to find you a buyer, whether it's from marketing, from open houses, from yard signs, from, or 4,500 of my best friends in the market. You're paying me to find them. And how I find that buyer is between me and the other people. So I think if you put in those terms, it's a lot easier to understand the seller's not paying the buyer. The seller's paying their agent. And one of the tools that you use is marketing to 4,500 other people that might have a suitor for your house. So I think if you look at it that way and explain it that way, it's a lot easier to pill to swallow. But you got to be on your game coming up because this is all over the news.
Well, Brad, thank you for coming back. Gosh, you begged and pleaded, and I finally had to relent. But you actually did good today. So I appreciate you being back on Dish and Dirt. And come back anytime, like 3 years from now.
All right, we'll do.
And that's all the time we have for our show today. If you'll please like us, subscribe to us, and share us with all the other real estate agents out there. Hope you all have a great weekend, and come join us again next week for another episode of Dish and Dirt.